Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this session. Welcome to Word of Life. And we want to welcome Father Jim. Father Jim is a Roman Catholic priest of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. He currently coordinates a spiritual formation of the permanent deacons in the Archdiocese. He's a senior lecturer of spiritual theology at LMU and associate spiritual director at the Cardinal Manning House of Prayer for Priests. In his spare time, he writes books. His newest book is Rethinking Catholic Devotions, Energy, Engagement, Transformation. And he travels around the country conducting retreats and workshops and conferences. He's a busy guy. Father Jim has been a friend of Word and Life for several years. We usually like to ask him to be the final speaker in our series to kind of wrap things up for us. So, without further ado, let's give Father Jim our blessing and turn it over to him.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Joe. Well, good morning once again. Good to see you all again. I'd like to begin with what I think is a very appropriate poem for this topic that we've been studying and unpacking for the last several weeks. It's called The Second Coming by William Butler Yeats. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it, real shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Jerusalem, Bethlehem to be born. So indeed, it feels like the center can't hold. And so, how do we unpack this topic of dealing with prophetic wisdom in an age of outrage? Well, let's go back to the basics. The nature of a mature religion is very simple and clear. All healthy world religions have at its core a single message that is meant to be imparted. Because healthy religion is about offering a container to hold the deep truths of life and dealing with the mystery of what is. So, the simplicity and the clarity of the Christian religion is about embracing divine love. Divine love can only be experienced, as the desert fathers and mothers have made so clear early on. It can only be experienced and not truly understood rationally. So, this is what wisdom is all about. It's about the application of insight into the details of one life, and why truly we can tell what a person believes by how they live their life. Does this sense of divine love, this experience of divine love, ooze out of their life in all the different aspects of their life, or is it just on Sundays? In the great or longer tradition of Christianity and most religions, we recognize that the gift, and I do mean that, the gift of what helps us to move to a deeper maturity is through disillusionment and the wounding of life, and why we all struggle with questions around death and pain and suffering. Why is this the necessary gateway? Because it's only then we realize that our rational ideas, our thoughts, our intellectual understanding get blown apart. And we come back again to what is it that holds us? What is it that allows us to experience the fullness of our humanity? And again, the simple and clear answer is divine love. That alone is what can hold the center. So, prophets across religious lines claim to have had such an experience of this divine love. And what's so beautiful and yet challenging is that they tell us that we can and must also have this experience. Secondhand religion really doesn't work very well. Going back to one of the first American psychiatrists, he had a wonderful quote in his book, Varieties of Religious Experience. He said, in his study of human happiness, there is no difference between those who practice what he called secondhand religion and the rest of the population. He said, only those who had an experience of divine love, what we call firsthand religion, they alone had a higher happiness quotient. So William was really adamant about this. The idea that one can practice religion and all, if you will, faithfulness, but without the experience, we just kind of limp along. So this is the foundation and the center on which a prophet's entire message rests. And that is the primary experience of divine love. Anything that gets in the way of this experience, this teaching, must be put aside. That is meant to be the driving force behind not only their message, but more importantly, their lifestyle. At their core, prophets are truth tellers and realists. And this is one of the reasons why people don't like prophets, and why, as Jesus said so clearly, why prophets tend to be silenced or killed outright. Because as much as we say it, we don't like the truth when someone speaks something to us. Years ago, when I was celebrating Eucharist at a local parish on Sunday, I dared to try and speak about who and what is a prophet. And I gave five very different examples of people who are either living or who have died. And I was really surprised when I came out of the church and turned around to greet the folks from the assembly. The first man out was an elderly man, and he came right for me with his finger pointing right at me and said, "How dare you? How dare you?" I'm thinking, okay, what did I say? And then he named one particular individual that I used, and I chose folks from all across the spectrum, conservative to liberal, use the name of that man in the same company as the other four. He says, "I've had an education at Georgetown and I know better." And I started to respond to his understanding of what I said. And I realized as he interrupted me, he didn't want any more input. He just walked off. That's the example of what a prophet does. It incites strong emotions, which is a good thing. It really is a good thing. Remember in the book of Revelation, we are told, I would rather that you be hot or cold rather than just lukewarm, because I would spit you out of my mouth. So truly, prophets are passionate women and men. These are individuals who are willing to speak to the truth of reality as they see it. Again, that's the clue, as they see it and experience it. So this makes it especially hard because we recognize in this day and time that evil and death are very much a part of reality. We can't erase them, and we can't live in denial of them. But we must learn how to accept them and to integrate them in the way that we relate to reality. Otherwise, in a very insidious way, they can destroy us and our belief system. So remember what Rohr points out is that evil necessarily relies on disguise. That's its major way of having an input or an impact in our life. Usually, the way that evil comes is an irrational, necessary, and expedient way of revelation. And that's why many people can be pulled in because, so, well, that makes sense. Yeah, that should resolve it. And typically, it also can come in very simplistic ways. So let me give you an example from biology. I'm told that you can try this yourself, though the frog won't appreciate it. But if you take a beaker full of water, and if you put the water at the temperature of the frog's bodily fluids and put the frog in, the frog will enjoy it and stay as long as you let the frog stay in the water. Then if you take the frog out and you heat the water to a boiling level and put the frog in, guess what the frog would do? Jump right out. Smart frog. But if you again get a bowl of water, again, it's the same temperature as the body fluids of the frog, put the frog in, and then slowly, very slowly, turn up the temperature degree by degree. Do you know what the frog will do? It'll stay in the water until it dies. That's what we're talking about. And this is what we're seeing happen today. That people will begin to compare, like what would happen last week. Oh, it's not as bad as last week. And it slowly begins to be heated up around us that we don't give it much attention at all. So this is why it's hard for us to truly see what's going on when we're in a difficult, chaotic, challenging situation. Think of our history in the sense of the Holocaust. So many people in Germany claim they didn't see or know what was going on. And they believed the words of the leadership. And they began to follow along. It's, well, yeah, this makes sense. This is we've had some really tough times. Here's what we need to do. In a similar way, think of our own time with the ICE raids and people wanting a quick, easy, simplistic way to deal with immigration and those who are not documented. So when prophets come into a situation, they insist on speaking truth to the soul. Notice the difference. The prophets speak to the soul. Leadership tends to try and speak to the intellect. And this is why the redirecting of people's focus to the soul is hard for us if we are not knowledgeable about the environment of the soul, how to nurture it, how to care for it, how to help its growth and maturity. The soul is nurtured by all different avenues, all different avenues. And the primary one is experience. The soul chews on, works with, tries to answer the questions that reality presents every single day. And the soul is not satisfied with simplistic answers. What the soul yearns for is finding ways and means of making connections. This is why, from the soul's perspective, it despises simplistic dualisms. But the intellect enjoys dualisms because there's a greater clarity. You know, oh, this is right, this is wrong. But the soul enjoys grayness because the soul is about both and this and that, male and female, up and down, heaven and earth, human and divine, microscopic, telescopic. All these things excite the soul because it's a way of expanding the inner perception. Again, this is why a prophet's message are so hard, so challenging to accept, because the prophet's messaging tends to be paradoxical and counterintuitive. Again, the prophet is speaking to the soul. And why many people give up because they, quote, don't understand it, or maybe a better way to say it, accept it, so they want to lean more into an intellectual understanding. I have met many, many people who have wonderful lifelong experiences in regards to the scriptures, to theology, have degrees in it, etc., that at least by lifestyle seem to be very far away from living the authentic message of the gospel. So with this insistence on speaking the truth, this is why in the Bible we see that every good king needs a prophet. Think of David and his prophet Nathan. He didn't like Nathan's message at all, but it changed David's life. So much so that God said, David is a man after my own heart. Wow. Where's that coming from? Because David knows his weaknesses, but he also balances that with his strength. And God blesses him. That's living a soulful life. Does it fly in the face of a well-ordered morality? Of course it does. And that's often the way things happen in reality. Therefore, how does that play out for us? Well, it means that every person in authority or positions of power need a truth speaker. Think of Abraham Lincoln. He purposely chose individuals that disagreed with him for his own cabinet because he knew that he was blind to many of his own shortcomings. He knew it would challenge him, but because he was a soulful man, he decided to do the both and. So he had people who agreed with him and people who disagreed with him, privately and publicly. So what is our job like the prophets? What are we to do? Our job is to guide people toward love. Let me repeat that. Our job in the prophetic tradition is to guide people toward experience of love, not to deliver them from struggle. It's not about taking away perhaps the entry point for people to mature, their own disillusionment, their own wounding. No. So I'll say it this way: prophets are not nice people in the traditional sense of nice. They are truthful people, they are compassionate people, they are deeply loving people. I remember one Southern pastor said it this way: sometime you have to leave them where the Lord flung them rather than trying to rescue someone. Or the story of a man who saw a young butterfly struggling to get out of its cocoon. And so he thought he'd be kind and help the butterfly get out of the cocoon. So he very carefully tore open the cocoon to let the butterfly out. What he didn't know is the struggle of being birthed was necessary for any butterfly. Because once the butterfly came out, still surrounded with all of its mucus, the butterfly could not open its wings and died shortly thereafter. It was only when the man went to talk to somebody who knew about butterflies, realized he'd made a terrible mistake. When we begin to take away the necessary suffering, the necessary struggles of people, and making it too easy, we miss out on what the prophets were trying to say over and over again. You must do this for yourself. One of the mechanisms that can help wake us up to our own lot in life is scapegoating. This is a long tradition of human beings. And certainly in Christianity, this is what Jesus did, is he chose to be the scapegoat for all humanity. He, in effect, said, whatever debt that someone owes you, let me pay it. And so his gift, nonviolent gift to dying on the cross, was simply that. Project onto me as scapegoat for all. Scapegoating, ideally, both psychologically and spiritually, is meant to wake us up. It's meant to help us to see ourselves more clearly, to see what we call our shadow side, our unacceptable side. And here's the the struggle for all of us, is that it's hard for us to admit, but the things that we see in other people that we despise, we gossip about, that tick us off, are inside us as well. That's why we can see them. If you spot it, you've got it. And so it doesn't mean that we push it aside. Instead, we embrace it. That scapegoat mechanism is meant to wake us up. Let me give you an example of my life. Two of the areas I've recognized over time that I have a hard time with in people is people that I perceive to be lazy and people who tend to be late to appointments. And I must admit, as I've sat with this in prayer over many years and really reflected on this, and loving people have pointed this gently to me, is that, yep, I've got it. I've got it. So I have to continually, whenever I find myself getting frustrated about once again noticing a person in my family or friendship circle or parish that exhibit these particular qualities, to realize, Jim, you've got it too. And again, to ask forgiveness for the judgmentalism. But at the same time, it leads me to the very place happens with the prophets, to tears. When am I get over this? When will I stop doing this? Well, the answer may be not in this lifetime. And you see, that's where the prophets end up. And what I really appreciated about this book is that Richard made it a point of walking with us through each of the major prophets and helps us to see that every single one except one started off with anger, righteous indignation, clarity of vision about what were the real issues in the people of God. Why weren't they doing all this and ranting and raving? And then slowly coming to a place of disgust as they woke up to the dawning realization of their own moral duplicity. And then they were moved to tears of awareness. And so it is for us. Those of us who are Christian, we say this language, we are baptized into the personhood of Christ, priest, prophet, and royalty. So what that means simply is that we too follow the same path. The same path. Think of John the Baptist, so many of the prophets that perhaps you hold in reverence. So hopefully in the end, we move to a place of solidarity with the victims. Remember the three times that Jesus wept. First was for his friend Lazarus. Secondly, certainly in the garden, Gethsemane. But perhaps more importantly to our topic, he sat across in the Kidron Valley from the old town of Jerusalem, and he wept for the people, knowing he had to give them life and liberation, but they were not ready or did not want it at all. One of the ways that I have found to join with the victims in solidarity and to remain hopefully at some level aware, is to create that prayer so biblical as, Father, forgive us. We know not what we do. And I find this especially helpful when I'm quick to want to judge some of our political leaders and religious leaders for what they're not doing or for what they're doing. And I repeat that prayer sometimes several times before I can calm down. Father, forgive us, for we do not know what we do. Now, those of us who have a difficult time admitting our anger, I certainly respect that. But please remember, anger is a gift. It's a necessary gift for us human beings. It lets us know from our perspective that something is wrong, something's off, and something needs to be addressed. When we choose not to face our anger or to deny it or to misname it, then what happens is it goes underground and it comes out in all sorts of ways. Bitterness, resentment, name-calling, gossip, jealousy, envy. But the one that we're seeing most common now is contempt. Contempt. In other words, contempt means you have no value to me. You are worth nothing. And this is what's fueling the divisiveness in families and friendships and creating such a division that people will not even face or talk to these individuals that they have such contempt for. What is needed, as Rohr points out, rather is sadness. Sadness is what saves us. It's what connects us. You think of the times when you experienced sadness as a family or as a community. Did it not pull you together if only for a day or two or three or four? Think of a national sadness, 9/11. Did you know the crime rate dropped for that first month after 9/11 happened? Sadness reminds us of our limitations, that we're all creatures. Sadness, when it's faced and embraced, becomes shared grief. It reminds us we belong together. It reminds us we're responsible for each other, every one of us, man, woman, child, and creature and creation. So the stories of the prophets, as Rohr has pointed out to us throughout this book, show us that process and growth are essential, that we can't waylay them. It's necessary for us, not only as human beings, but as creatures. The Creator is constantly moving forward, inviting us into the new, the ever-present. And so we too must do the same. So as for the prophets, so for us. They start out angry and divisive, and gradually they evolve through God's own divine love and experience. They're moved to tears, just like Jesus, just like us. So our tears remind us that we're not alone. So if we're not willing to look at our own unhealthy ego or shadow, then again, they will depend on disguises, which is even harder to unpack. So a definition of a healthy ego, it's like a cork that's bobbing on the surface of the ocean. An unhealthy ego, egotistical, unhealthy ego is when the cork thinks it's the ocean. So being ego-driven is not a good place to be. I remember a wonderful story that happened, unfolded in my office many years ago when I was working with a young couple preparing for marriage. And we got to the point of talking about family history. And I turned to the young man and asked him about his parents. All of a sudden, I could see this anger flash on his face. He said, "No respect for my parents." I said, "Oh?" He said, "No, none whatsoever." He said, "My dad is a drug addict. My mom is an alcoholic. They have no control over life." I said, "Okay, I'm sorry to hear that." He says, "Yeah." He says, "I've made a promise that I'll not allow myself to slip into any type of addiction." So later on in the interview, we got to the point where I asked each of them separately, "So what would you like to change? What is one thing you'd like to change about the other person?" Well, when it was time for the woman to talk, she said, "What I'd like him to change is to change his dangerous activities that he does." And I said, "Oh?" I turned to him, I said, "What are those?" "Well, he liked to race motorcycles. He liked to do hang gliding, and he also liked to what was the third thing? All three of them were quite dangerous. And so I smiled and I said, "So you told me you're not an addict." He said, "I'm not." He said that very proudly. I says, "Well, it sounds to me like you are. You're addicted to adrenaline." Oh my gosh. I thought he was going to jump and choke me. He was that angry. He couldn't receive the way I reframed the truth of his life. I got him to calm down. I said, "Now, in just a few weeks, you're going to be marrying this woman, and she's only asking you to change one thing. She didn't ask you to let go of all these, just one. Can you not do this for love?" He left saying, "I'll have to think about that." Wow. Wow. You see, his ego could not accept, one, that he was an addict, two, that maybe love is better than the power he was experiencing in relationship to his body and to these adrenaline-enriching experiences. So the Bible demands that we grow up and allow our notion of God to grow up right along with it. That may say sound strange to say that, but let me remind you that at about the same time this was all unfolding, the Greek and the Roman pantheon of gods and goddesses were a way that these people saw the gods acting out. Today we'd call that a sacred psychology. However, in the monotheistic religion of Judaism, it was different. The authors put together God growing up with God's people. Very different, but very insightful. So, this is why, in the Hebrew scriptures, for example, we see that God evolves from anger and fear to tears of love. That there's a deepening relationship based in trust and truth, not threat and fear. Unfortunately, many people have not got this message, and why we project onto God our own hatreds, our own judgmentalism, and we very clearly want to define that certain people are in hell. Certain people are in hell. In the Catholic Church, we have a dogmatic pronouncement that there's a hell. One of the things that I like about being a Catholic is that the church also is defined. We have no idea if anybody's there. You go, how's that possible? Well, think of the story that Richard shared at the very end of the chapter about the angel and the brazier of fire, the bucket of water. Because it's our need to want to punish certain people or have them punished in our name. Why? Because in the end, what we say is God is mystery. God is mercy within mercy within mercy. And this love, which is so profound and complete, we don't know what God's going to do at the end time. And so we say that all people are in the hands of God. One of the things that really makes this thing difficult is that most of us have been brought up in religion, have been taught, first off, you got to get your act together, change your behavior. Then you got to know who you belong to. And then, oh, by the way, yes, you're deeply loved. Actually, that's backwards. First, it's meant to be introduced, as the prophets point out, to our beingness, that we are in relationship with God, who is love. We are named as God's beloved. That's who we are, and that's what we are in relationship. Then we learn about the fact that we belong to each other. We belong to this whole wide creation. And then finally, we move into right behavior. Notice the difference. It's putting the mystical experience first, not last. So to put it this way, poetically, God invites us to see, feel and be as God is, as Meister Eckhart, a German mystic, would say. That is God's invitation to us and drive for us to accept. This work is an ongoing work. God is always with us in whatever circumstance. Now, why is it so hard for us to see Jesus as a prophet? We see him living out many different roles in our theologies, in our names of our churches. In the Catholic Church, we have lots of churches named Christ as King or Christ the High Priest. We see Jesus as a warrior or lover, but I don't know of any Catholic church but named Christ the Prophet. I think the reason being is that, at least in America, as Americans, we tend to personalize Jesus. In other words, I hear over and over again people say, "He came to save me." Well, actually, that's not true. He didn't come to save you. He came to save all creation. That's a big difference. And why we speak about the universal Christ, not the personal Jesus. Jesus was an historical figure. The universal Christ is for everyone. And how we apply, accept, receive, whatever word you like, into our lives. This is the task. And this is what the prophets were trying to wake people up to. The prophets in the past and the present prophets as well. What's good for one is good for all. The prophets make God's way of loving action the source, the goal, the summit, the criterion, and standard for all human morality and behavior. This is so important for us. You know, when you hear stories of human beings that when they're quite young, they're brought up in a household where there was no love or very little love, it's easier for us to understand why their life has come apart at the seams. Why is it so hard for us to see that that happens for a lot of people, more than you realize? Today, we call that toxic shame. We call that post-traumatic stress disorders. We have different words for it, but it's the same thing. It's people who are disconnected from the reality of knowing and being in love with the divine creator. So this is why, as we mature in our spirituality, we learn not so much to seek answers. That's the arena for the young, the immature. But maturity in religion necessitates that we learn how to ask good questions, meaningful questions. That's exactly what the prophets did. That's exactly what Jesus did. For example, rather than saying, "Why is this happening to me? Why is God punishing me?" Doesn't that sound like a little kid? "Not my fault." Better question is, "God, what's going on here? What are you doing with me? What am I supposed to learn from this?" And perhaps a more personal question is, "What can I do, Lord? How can I respond to this particular situation in the here and now?" As you well know, God is active, not passive. And we are to follow this pattern. It is not meant to be about attending and belonging to a certain group, gathering together each Sunday or Wednesday or whatever day of the week. It's meant to be, how do we put this into practice? Every day, in the way we talk, the way we act, the way we relate. So, this is important for us to realize that this work the prophets calls us to a place as Americans we do not want to go. And that is a place of vulnerability, a place of companionship, place of surrender, because these are the attitudes and the actions that create authentic community, authentic relationship. May come as a surprise to you, but that the prophets were radical traditionalists whose conservatism made them into tearful and empathetic progressives, at least progressives in the way we understand that term today. Think of someone like Dorothy Day. Here's this passionate woman who is very simple in the way she practiced her Catholic faith. But I got to tell you, she was radical in the way that she got back to the basics of the gospel message, to care for everyone, especially those who are most in need. And she was ridiculed and maligned for it and misnamed. She was a prophet in her own way because she dared to go back to the basics. So those of us who practice what might be called a devotional spirituality, and that simply means focusing on prayer forms or spiritual practices that help you to connect with God's love for you. That's great, but there's a purpose for it. The purpose is to point us in the direction of prophetic spirituality. And that spirituality is okay, the responsibility of being loved, passing on that message. What does that look like in reality? On page 162 and 163, you have a list that Richard Rohr has put together on the way of the prophet. And it's a wonderful short list to remind us that these are the ways, the aspects that we too can incorporate into our own life in attitude and practice to balance both devotional spirituality and prophetic spirituality. That, think of it as like the right hand and the left hand meant to work together. There's a necessary role of social criticism, of course, but the ideal prophet is one who knows and accepts and integrates his or her own woundedness. Something must break us out of our own self-serving, self-centered way of looking at life. This is the work that's given to each one of us. So I know we've all read this story, but I'd like to repeat it as a way of closing my presentation. This story, like Richard, I heard decades ago, but it to me is the best one to really help us to break through our own glass ceiling, the way we look at God or look at the prophetic ministry. The story about an angel who's walking down the street and he encounters this woman. Said, "Sir, where are you going?" And he says, "I'm carrying this bucket of water and I'm carrying this flaming torch and I'm going down to the fires of hell to put out all the fire. I'm going up to heaven to burn down all the mansions, and then we'll finally find out who really believes in God." Can you believe in a God who loves everyone and everything and is patient with the process unfolding? Can you accept that God invites you into that way of seeing and knowing reality as God sees and knows it? That's the question for all of us. So we're going to send you off into your groups. And the two questions that I have, Tim is going to put up in just a minute, but I'll just say them verbally. Where is God inviting you to unpack your anger and respond creatively and gracefully? Where is God inviting you to unpack your own anger and respond creatively and gracefully? And secondly, how is God inviting you to open your heart to a larger view and experience of all creation? So blessings on your time of sharing.
All right, well, here we are back together. Got about 17 minutes or so for some more conversation with Father Jim. I don't know, Jim, if you have any opening comments you'd like to make. Otherwise, we can go straight into.
We can go straight into the questions.
Okay, great. Yeah, Rev Jen, you want to unmute and go ahead?
So our group focused on breakdowns in relationships. Particularly where they really felt unreconcilable. And these were long-term relationships in both of our examples. And in my example, the person just wants to move on and not interact at all. And I didn't expect that. I expected to be able to be in a continuing conversation. And so I'm not comfortable with just not responding at all. I want to write something, some kind of thing that would leave us some sort of possibility and stuff, but I'm just sort of sitting with that. And I guess my question is, when someone says, I just really don't want to interact anymore, I just want to move on, is it should that just be respected? Should I just go, okay? Or should I honor my need to somehow try to have some kind of completion that has some loving possibility for the future?
Great question. Thank you. I would say both. In other words, I would recommend that you write what I would call a love letter. Like you said, you obviously had a history with this person, and I do mean write. So it'd go to their land mail. And that way, if they choose to keep the letter, they can. But by writing it, you're honoring not only yourself and your feelings, but the relationship. And then you can finish off by saying, "So unless I hear from you, I accept your desire. I'll honor your desire and not communicate with you again. But just know my heart's open. If you'd ever like to pick up from a new place or wherever you like." That would be prophetic, the both and. Yeah.
I like that, both and. Thank you so
Okay.
much. That's a wonderful
You're welcome.
way of proceeding. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, Jackie, you want to go ahead?
Yes. Herself.
I think she got muted. You got muted, Jackie.
Yeah, Jackie, you were already unmuted. You just need to unmute. There you go.
There I am. All right. I had to push that three times before it worked. Thank you for less life. Thank you for your presentation because I had so many things I wanted to write down. I couldn't write it all down. They were so beautiful. But I had one little disagreement, let's say, or something that wasn't enlarged upon. You said prophets speak their own truth. And as I understand it, prophets do not speak their own truth so much as they speak God's truth. They say what God wants them to say. They're so often reluctant, they never wanted to do it in the first place, and out pop these gems. So I think we can all be prophets in the same way. Haven't you
Yeah.
said something and suddenly been taken aback? Did I say that? Where did that come from? Well, that's being a prophet.
I agree, Jackie. Perhaps I wasn't clear then. The universal truth of God or God's message necessarily has to come to the venue of a personal life, a personal message. So when I say that they're speaking their truth, it's they've heard God's voice, God's direction, God's sense, but now it's being shared through their life. That's one of the reasons why I was sharing so many of my own stories, is that it just becomes rational, not mumbo jumbo, but you know what I mean, just so general that it doesn't land anywhere. But when it lands in somebody's own personal life and story, then, oh, I get it. So this is why whenever we honor a prophet, we want to know their background, their story, their personal experience of the divine. So that's what I meant.
There were a lot of people who think they're prophets, the people that used to find on street corners shouting out things.
Yeah.
That's not my idea of a true prophet.
No, I agree. And if you know anything about the prophetic writings in the Bible as we know it, the reason we have those writings and not other writings from other prophets is it took time for the community to realize, oh, that person was speaking a real prophetic truth given to us by God. Maybe we couldn't understand or accept it then, but now we realize we need to honor this by putting it in writing.
How did anybody ever accept Ezekiel, for example?
Oh, exactly. Talk about a drama king or queen, whatever you want to call him. But yeah, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah, Catherine, I see your hand. Go ahead.
Well, Father Jim, I need a little more help.
Sure.
Because you gave a you offered a good tool, which has worked very well in interpersonal relationships and other kinds of things in my life. Forgive them, they know not what they do.
Yeah.
But this all seems very strategic to me. And so when I try to calm my nervous system, I go, oh no, there it's very evident and strategic what's being done in that political kind of realm. So can you give me another, can you throw me another loaf of bread there, please?
Sure, Catherine. Ha happy to do that.
A little balm for my dissonance, please.
Okay. Well, first off, I think a good question for you in your prayer is, Lord, what can I do? What do you want me to do? Because remember, all of us are coming from a place of feeling victimized or feeling powerless. And one of the ways it will empower you is that you bring your prayer, the fruits of your prayer, to life in terms of an active response. So what would it be like for you? Okay. It could be, doing something completely different that's out of character for you. It could be something that you're already doing in your life, but you want to expand it. But the key, the first step is, okay, Lord, what do you want me to do? Please make it very clear. And you don't need to rush into it, but gradually you'll get this prompt or this sense or this intuitive nudge that, oh, okay, I can do that. Okay.
Thank you. God
You're
is
welcome.
constantly prompting me.
There
But
you go.
I'm saying, how can we stretch time further, God? But wait for that answer too.
Yeah. Okay.
What else? Anything else need to be mentioned or offered up? Yeah, Alice, you want to unmute and go ahead.
Thank you, Father Jim. Good to see you again.
Likewise, Alice.
Just you said many things upon which I'll reflect, but one thing that you said that struck me, and let me see, I did write it down here somewhere. Well, you used a word that is happening right now and fueling the divisions that I hadn't really thought about, and that's contempt.
Yes.
I thank you for that word because it actually is the word that describes so much of the rhetoric and so much of what I see that really saddens me
Yeah.
is the level of contempt, looking down upon another human being.
Yeah.
Anyhow, it's a good thing to reflect upon,
Yeah.
and I want to thank you for that. P very hard to work our way through this type of thing. But
Yeah.
anyhow, thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. That also helps us to explain and understand why these type of, if you want to call them, discussions, when they revolve around contempt for one's family members, why it separates and divides a family. Because when you dehumanize a person or a group, you don't have to deal with them. So, yeah.
And I love the opening poem. That's pretty profound, and it names pretty well
Yeah.
exactly what's going on. Thank you for that. I'm going
You're
to look
welcome.
that up.
You're welcome.
Maybe you can send that to me, Father Jim, and I can send that on to people
Okay.
in the follow-up. Thank you.
Okay.
Another thing that got triggered when you were speaking about the creation stories, I remember Daniel Smith Christopher
Yep.
from LMU saying in his Old Testament class that the difference of the story in Genesis as opposed to the stories in the surrounding nations, is the creation story in Genesis was meant to emphasize that God created with intention and compassion, not out of war and conflict like the surrounding creation stories. That highly impressed me because those two words, intention and compassion, are very masculine, feminine words. The intent, the masculine intent to create, and the feminine expansive space of compassion. And I do think that that is the difference in how we were created. We were created in love, not out of war and conflict. So thank
Amen.
you.
I agree. Well, let me go ahead and conclude with two stories. One is a story that happened in Texas. Several of you have been asking it one way or another, how in the world do we cross the divide? There was a pastor there who was very, very concerned about the woman in his community because they were literally at each other's throats over the issue of a woman's right over her own body or the right of life in a woman's womb. And so, as a result, he was talking to a friend of his who was very knowledgeable in this area. And she said to him, that's my area of expertise is to reconcile groups from different perspectives. Would you be willing to let me come to your parish? And he goes, would I, by all means. So he put out a wonderful advertisement to all the women. He says, as a personal favor, I'm going to ask all of you women to come to a meeting this Saturday. And I have a friend of mine who would like to be able to talk with you. He didn't say talk to, he said talk with you. So the woman came and they filled the auditorium. And all he did was introduce his friend and then he left. And at the end of the day, at 3 o'clock, he came back and he was stunned as every single woman that came out was smiling. Some were holding hands, some were embracing each other. And so he started asking questions of what happened? And they said, we learned how to listen to each other's stories. And they agreed, both sides, if we can use that, they would no longer speak mean about the other person or other issues. But not a single woman changed the perspective in terms of how they would vote, how they felt. But they felt respected and honored that their stories were told. So I'll leave you with that concept via a story from Pakistan. It's a creation story. Is that when we listen to people's stories, new creation happens. And here's the way the story goes. Unlike some creation stories, this one has a real twist to it. God decided to create human beings as female and male. And this went on for quite a while as he began to watch over time more and more disagreements, divisions, conflicts, and even wars broke out. And there seemed no hope whatsoever. And so one of his favorite angels came to him and says, not working out too well. He said, no. He said, I think that was going to be my first model. I have an idea of how to help change this. And so he asked the angel to bring over a container. And then God put some extra material in the container. And he said, here, let's try plan B. And with that, he created a different human being, female and male. And then he set them loose. And over a period of time, the angels began to watch, thinking, okay, let's hope this works better than the first. And they noticed there was a definite difference in the sense of not only the energy, but the way that the people related. They too disagreed and had their conflicts, but they always came back together. And so the angel said, what'd you do? And he said, I added stories to the mix. I added stories to the mix. So goose happens when we listen to each other's stories. That's a technique that I've learned and that I have found to be very helpful in my own life, for my family, and my ministry, is when you're in disagreement, say, could you tell me a story of how you came to that perspective? Can you help me understand where you begin to believe this? And listen carefully, and you'll begin to see, oh my gosh, this makes a lot more sense. And that's how we speak heart to heart. So God bless you, and thank you for making your way through this lovely book. I think it's one of the best that the Word in Life has worked on, in the sense of very appropriate for its time. So God bless you. Thanks.
All right, thank you, Jim.
You're welcome, Joe. You know,
Yeah, thank
what a
you.
privilege, I think, for all of us to be able to sit at the feet of people like Father Jim and pick his brain a little bit. I think this has been a great series. Richard Rohr and our slate of speakers has given us a lot to think about. I think it's been a hope-filled series. If we're paying attention to what's going on in the world, we can get pretty discouraged. And we find these Thursday morning get-togethers to be uplifting. They remind us that there's a bigger picture going on, and that we're part of a community of believers working in lots of little ways and big ways to make this world a kinder, more loving place. You know, we've been able to meet many of you in the breakout rooms, and Kathy and I think we get as much out of those sharings as we do from the book and the speakers. So thank you all for being part of Word and Life. You know, you form the community, you pay the bills, and you motivate us on the steering committee to keep up this good and important work.
Word in life.
And then I think Judith is going to give us some information about a free lunch.
Lunch, right? And I think, Tim, that Lee Menachella is trying to talk to us. Maybe he's calling me on the phone here. So yes, I just echo what Joe said about the series. This last chapter was really wonderful for me. It all comes down to love. That's a wonderful ending. And I want to read the last chapter, the last sentence of the book, because this is, the whole book was wonderful, but this is really struck me. Wherever you are on your spiritual journey, that's where God is. So with that, we're going to finish Word and Life and the tiers of things. But now I want to have you know what's going on for the winter. We have a selected a book. What? Something's wrong with me. It is called Sp Ecological Spirituality, and it's by Dearmuid and Mertju, and it's going to start on January 15th, and it's going to go on to March 19th, and the luncheon after that will be March 26th. Then we have some speakers already signed up for you. Our wonderful Alice McDonald is one of the speakers. We're going to start on January 15th with the video of the author. And it is an interview by Orbis Books, the fellow that owns Orbis Books. And Dearmuid is going to be speaking about the whole book. That's the first session,
Name.
January 15th. And then we're going on, we have five of the speakers all lined up. Alice is speaking along with Dr. Joseph Brochak. You might remember him. He's the indigenous fellow from a speaker from New York. And then on in February, Dearmuid himself, Father Dearmuid himself, is going to be coming from Dublin on Zoom. And then this morning before the presentation here, Father Jim signed up for March 5th. He's going to be speaking to us March 5th. And then our own Tim Burnett is going to be one of the speakers too. So we wanted to make sure, and we'll send out the sign-ups in the middle of December, right before Christmas. So that's in the winter. And then for the May, in the spring, we have Dr. David Rico is coming with Sweeter Than Revenge. This is the May, and there's four Thursdays in May. So there you're all brought up to what's happening in the winter, in the spring, and we'll see you all at the luncheon, and it's at noon, 2101 State Street. People, if you can get here, please come from far and wide, And it doesn't matter. And where there's no pay, no money, just come and bring a dish. And Alice is going to be the speaker. She's going to summarize the whole thing and tell us all about Word and Life and how it all began and where we are now and where we're going. So with that, let's unmute. Thanks, Father Jim, for a wonderful, wonderful presentation. And we'll see you in March, Jim. Okay.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Father.
you. Thank you,
Thank
Father
you.
Jim.
Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Thank
Thanks,
you, everybody.
everybody.
See you soon.
Another awesome program.
Thank you.
Great program.
Thank you. Great program. Thank
I'll
you.
miss you guys.
Thank you.
Take care, y'all.
Thank you, Tim.
Bye.
Thank you, Tim.
Bye. Thank
Yeah.
you.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you,
Thanks,
Father Jim.
You're
Thanks,
welcome. We'll see you all soon.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, Judith.
Thank you, Father Jim.
Thanks, Father.
Thank you very much.